Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect. Show's coming to you from Bristol City Centre, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to all our listeners in Bristol, and our listeners on Preston FM on 103.2, and also to our listeners in Swindon and Radio Verulam in St Albans. Our guest this week is Jack Higgins, who's here to talk about his punk rock group, TLI. What does that stand for? Well, he'll tell us later on. We have features from Anthea Page and also Tony Gosling. Our engineer, Michael Noyce, brings us another sofa session, and this week he talks to Lewis Creven. Malcolm Grieve reads us Chapter 27, Part 1, of Treasure Island, and we also have some poetry later on, and Jeff Sparks will be bringing us the Watson Guide and the Song of the Week. I'm John Peters Coleman, the presenter of this week's show. In the studio with me now is TLI's vocalist and guitarist, Jack Higgins.
Hi, you alright?
Very well, thank you, yeah, good. You're looking very batters, springs to mind.
Yeah, you've got your Batman t-shirt. Batman t-shirt, and yeah, you got a love for superheroes.
Yeah, did you like the Batman movie?
Yeah, it was good, I can't wait for the next one to come out.
Brilliant. So, first things first, I guess, TLI, what does that stand for?
Well, we kind of like to get people to guess, so I think, what was your guess beforehand?
Later on, and I thought it might, TL brought to mind, as in TLC, tender loving, so I thought, insults maybe? Tender loving insults? I don't know, is that?
No, it stands for the local idiots, and yeah, we kind of just sort of shortened it, just because we're idiots like that.
Okay, self-deprecatory, perhaps, is
maybe.
Yeah, your mode of thought. Okay, well, how long have you been in a group?
Been together for around about 3 years now, like, gigging properly. Before that, it was just sort of school sort of gigs and bits and pieces.
How many of you are there?
There's three of us. So there's myself and Wes, who's on bass, and Jake, who's on drums.
Okay, so I'm assuming also you're the guitarist.
I am indeed.
Indeed, playing a song. Tell us a little bit about your background in punk rock. I mean, where did you sort of start hearing about punk? What are your first memories of it?
I am not entirely sure. My dad's always been quite into punk, and so I guess I can sort of like draw from that, and I think it's a sort of similar kind of thing with all of our dads, really. But no, we all got together, and the idea, the start, was to make an indie band, because that seemed to be what all the girls were into, and it's what we were all into, so it just seemed like a logical choice. Yeah, we started making music, and then we came to recording some demos and played them to some friends and some people we knew, and they said, oh, that just sounds like old punk music. And yeah, next thing we knew, we were playing a punk show, and we sort of just went from there.
So you sort of like punk by mistake?
Yeah, it's kind of, if a punk label, as if you will, like, it kind of found us rather than us finding it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. You've got quite an excellent moustache. Do you twiddle that on a regular basis?
I can twiddle it. It's like, yeah, mainly sort of growing a beard and moustache purely just to annoy the girlfriend.
Yeah. Okay, did she take to the twiddly moustache particularly?
No, she hates it.
She hates it, okay. But you're still sticking to your guns though, aren't you?
Yeah. Just go all.
Okay.
I'd feel bad shaving it at the moment, it being November and such, but... And yeah, not particularly growing it for any sort of reason, maybe just because it looks quite gentlemanly.
In some ways, I mean, this is an irritating question, I admit, but I mean, what do you think you sound like in terms of current artists? So who does your band sort of sound like?
Oh, in terms of current artists, it is quite a tricky one. We draw our influences from all over the shop, really, from bands like Florence Arms, Alkaline Trio, Nuffington, but then we've also got sort of older influences like Stiff Little Fingers, and Sham 69, and obviously the Sex Pistols, because it's hard to be in a punk band without being influenced by them.
Indeed.
But yeah, we just have our influences from all over the shop, really, so it's hard to sort of, like, pick one and say, that's what we sound like.
Do you think that's common for a lot of bands of your generation, recent generations? A lot of people seem to say that now.
Yeah, I imagine so, really, because, like I said, we've all got such a huge music taste. I know our drummer, Jake, he's quite into Latin, so... Yeah,
does that creep through in anything?
Oh, in sort of little breakdowns. Wes and Jake like to go off on little sort of tangents while I go and tell stories, and they like coming up with little Latin funk breakdowns.
Okay, cool. Are you assuming that you use MySpace and internet technology and Facebook to spread the word?
Yeah, we're all over that. We're mainly the website, and then / TLI band, apart from Reverb Nation, which is just pretty much TLI. But yeah. Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, everything.
exploring to what extent that's really useful. I mean, how many people would you say, you know, are likely to sign up at a gig as a result of you putting something on Facebook or MySpace?
A fair few, really. I mean, if it weren't for social networks like Facebook and Twitter, people wouldn't find out about the gigs.
I mean, I imagine not quite a lot of people that you already know are likely to be making quite a large percentage of the people in your audience.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely.
Word of mouth would probably also spread the word as well.
Yeah.
But you're finding that other people who aren't part of your social circle are also finding out about it and attending as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, if it weren't for these tools that are available to us now, no one would hear about it. And like, it's hard to think how they kind of even spread it out in the old days and got the word out there.
But, yeah. What do you think of the state of the music scene in terms of venues at the moment? Do you think there are many places for you to play, or do you kind of feel a bit restricted?
I think, well, there's more than enough places to play. As for the music scene at the moment, I think there's a kind of general feeling of apathy toward live music at the moment. Well, more of a general feeling of apathy towards going out at all. But
why do you think that?
Well, it's a mix of things. I think it's where people haven't had the money to go out, they're not going out and they're staying in. But when people do come to the gigs, which they do, it's quite nice and reassuring to see that there is still that market out there and people do want to come watch live music.
Okay, well, I guess you got the reassurance that the people who actually bother to turn out are the hardcore. No casuals, no stragglers. Well, where do you want the band to go, realistically? I mean, have you got, like, your sights set on, like, the stars?
It'd be nice if we could be the first band to play on the moon. That'd be quite nice. It's a realistic dream.
Yeah, don't limit yourself, will you? Like, you know, go for it. Tell me a little bit about where you want your band to go. I mean, do you want to sort of be touring around the country a little bit, or do you just see yourself sticking around Bristol? Or?
We already kind of play all over the shop, really. It's not just Bristol shows we do. We go, like you said, all around the country at the moment. But it's just where we are now is kind of trying to branch out into different places we haven't played. For example, at the moment we're trying to play in Oxford and in Southampton and... yeah, loads of other places like that.
How difficult is that? I mean, what do you do if you're in a band and you think, well, you know, I fancy playing some gigs in other cities? You have to know the promoters who work there, I guess.
Yeah, well, it just comes down to sort of like dropping an email, making a phone call. And what we found really helpful is if we can meet other people in bands from those cities and then organise kind of gig swaps with them.
Okay.
So we can get them a gig here, speak to the promoters here, they'll put them on the bill, and then in return they'll kind of do the same for us.
Where do you notice around the country that punk seems to be going down really well at the moment?
Ooh, that is a tricky one. Well, back here, obviously, it's a pretty good scene. Bristol's quite a brilliant place for live music anyway.
Yeah.
Punk's kicking off the most.
Anywhere that's the most unusual place that you've played and saying, oh, I didn't really expect that I was going to get many people turn up to this
one? Well, we've had unusual places. We played at a place in Wales that was just... really, really bizarre.
What was that like? Where was it?
It was at a Labour club. And it was a charity fun day. So we'd gone along, thought we'd do a good deed, and like there was barely anyone there. It was the middle of the day, boiling hot. We just played in Swindon the day before, and we were all horrendously hungover and probably still a little bit sort of high from the night before as well.
Yeah.
And we were all just in this weird place in the middle of nowhere.
You're sweating out the toxins, in the middle
sweating
of Wales.
Out the toxins, and this old woman appeared who lived next door to this Labour club.
Yeah.
And offered us in for a shower.
Right. She could smell you from where she was standing there.
Yeah, right? It was just downright odd. She just came out and said, oh, does anybody want a cup of tea? We're like, oh, yeah, that'd be absolutely brilliant. And she was like, all right, I'll go put the kettle on. Does anybody want to pop in for a shower?
Sure she didn't have any secret cameras set up in there?
She may have had, like, what, a try out a new glory hole she just made or something.
Oh, no, let's not go down that avenue. I mean, I joke about that, being filmed in the shower did actually happen to met him in New Zealand, and I felt incredibly sorry for him, and I was surprised that he didn't get quite violent. It seemed quite reasonable under the circumstances. DIY is quite a big thing about punk. I mean, in particular, I think you mentioned earlier on that you are a gentleman punk, is this right?
Yes, a kind of... It's like being in a punk band, it's that kind of name kind of found us, as opposed to...
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, almost sort of do-it-yourselfism and gentlemanliness seem sort of opposites.
Yeah.
Do you find they work quite well in your band?
Yeah. I think the gentleman kind of thing comes from, like, because we're punks, but then we're quite nice about it. And quite nice chaps as well. And I think this mustache is helping. But yeah, I think they are two things which could be one in the same, in effect.
Oh, okay. Do you see yourself as part of the steampunk movement in any way, perhaps?
No, not particularly at the moment. It'd be nice to branch out into that fan base, as it were.
Yeah.
Because it's really fun, and I love all the contraptions they make for themselves. But
cool. Got to wrap things up, sadly, but how can people listen to your music and see if they're into it?
They can head to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/TLIBand, or they can follow us on Twitter @TLIBand, or if they still use MySpace, which I think some people may, Tom, who made MySpace, definitely does, but yeah, they can find us on that, Google+, Reverb Nation, everything.
The whole lot. One last question, I guess, before we go. Have you got any gigs coming up that people can go to?
Yes, we've got one at the Croft on the 12th of December, and that is with Blitzkids.
Ah, okay, excellent. Jack Higgins, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our reporter Anthea Page went to an Amnesty International meeting recently, and the reporter found out about the current situation in Bhopal, which is in Madhya Pradesh in India. Well, what's happening in Bhopal, you ask yourself? Well, 27 years ago, the Bhopal disaster occurred, also known as the Bhopal gas tragedy. It was a gas leak accident in India and was considered one of the worst industrial catastrophes. It occurred on the night of December the 2nd to the 3rd, 1984, at the Union Carbide India Limited pesticide plant. A leak of chemicals from the plant resulted in the exposure of hundreds of thousands of people in the area to deadly gases. Estimates vary on the death toll. The government of Madhya Pradesh has confirmed a total of nearly 4,000 related to the gas release, and the government affidavit from 5 years ago said the leak caused 558,125 injuries. The factory itself was built in 1969 to produce the brand name pesticide Severin, and on the night of the incident, water entered a tank, just water, and entered 42 tonnes of the gas, and the resulting reaction increased the temperature inside the tank to over 200 degrees centigrade and raised the pressure, which made the tank vent and a load of toxic gas spilled out into the surrounding area. Well, the world has forgotten the Bhopal tragedy, but the people who live there in Madhya Pradesh continue to be affected by the leak still, after all these years, and Anthea Page found out more about what is going on in Bhopal now.
My name's Victoria Sutton. A lot of people know me as Tori.
Can you tell us about your recent trip to Bhopal in India? What's happening over there?
In 1984, when Union Carbide built a factory in Bhopal, there was a very large gas explosion and big poisonous gases went across the poorer part of India, poisoning the residents. Many of them died. Women lost their children on that night. And the ones who survived are left with a catalogue of the health complaints. Babies that are born now are born... They call them monstrous births. They're born with deformities. You know, the health catalogue in Bhopal is terrible and still continuing now, and nothing really has been done to resolve that.
Why hasn't anyone done anything?
Well, the company responsible, Union Carbide, was bought out by Dow, and they say that it's not their responsibility to do anything about this. Kind of these people have just been left on their own, basically, to suffer. They were poor to begin with, and now with all the health problems they're having, Dow have just stepped back and said, this is nothing to do with us.
What about the American government? Could they do something?
Well, Barack Obama was over in India recently. Amnesty was saying that he should be addressing this. You know, this was the world's worst industrial disaster, that he should be addressing this while he was here. And that was avoided entirely while he made his trip to India. So even though it's an American company that are responsible for this, the American government are doing nothing to push them to take responsibility for what's happened.
Tell us what you saw when you were over there.
The clinic that's built, the Sabhavna Clinic, which has been built in Bhopal to help the victims of the gas, and this is a clinic that's been built by volunteers, victims of the gas disaster themselves, is a beautiful place. It's a place for healing, it's a place of compassion. It's got a very large herb garden, Western medicines to help the people with their health complaints. It's a very poor area that the clinic is in. There's a lot of poverty everywhere. And I took a trip to the actual plant itself, and it's just been left, I would say, as it was when they packed up and left back in the 80s. There are bottles and sacks of waste everywhere. Big lake of dirty water, which the locals often use to drink from because they run out of not exactly clean water, but water that's shipped in for them. I saw the waste from what they were creating that people used to build the floor in their homes. So I saw a lot of destruction, a lot of disease, and but still of such a positive spirit amongst the people that live there. The people were just so beautiful. They were smiling and welcoming, even though they were going through these just absolutely terrible things. It was an amazing trip, and I highly recommend anyone to go. They're always welcome for people to spend time there, just visiting or helping in any way you can.
Now, the factory employed a lot of people, so what do people do now for money? Do they have jobs?
The people that were affected by the gas, a lot of them were unable to work due to the gas, respiratory problems, a lot of pain, women have menstrual problems, and a lot of them actually have psychological problems now, and they aren't recognised at all. Some of them got a very small amount of compensation given by the government, but one figure I read was $300 to $500. I mean, this isn't very much at all. Most of it has run out, so a lot of them are just begging on the streets. If they've got family to support them, they're lucky. If they don't, they're just in dire poverty.
Just remind me again, are there still children being born deformed in Bhopal after all this time?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I said children are born with webbed fingers. I've read reports of children born with three eyes, one eye, missing brains, cleft palates, one foot large, the other foot small, limbs on the wrong way. We know that these things happen in nature, and naturally there are things that is happening, but the percentage of these cases is enormous in Bhopal, and they've tested mother's breast milk and they find mercury and other very dangerous substances in their breast milk. It's in the groundwater, so yet babies are still being born.
What happens to babies? Are they just left to die because the families can't cope?
I don't know if they're left to die. A lot of them do die, I think, because their health problems are so terrible, and Sabhavana Clinic does its best to try to correct and to, I wouldn't say cure, but do their best to ease their pain and discomfort. I think the families look after them the best they can, but a lot of the families themselves are destitute, so I think a lot of them will die, definitely.
You're speaking tonight on behalf of Amnesty. What can Amnesty do in Bhopal?
Amnesty, when I had the 25-year anniversary, did do a lot to raise awareness about Bhopal and what happened there, because a lot of people have not heard of Bhopal. If you say, oh, Bhopal, they've no idea. I mean, it was the world's worst industrial disaster to date, I believe. So all we can do is keep raising awareness, keep writing postcards off to Dad, keep writing to the American government, keep raising awareness so that people can say, how can this happen? A company that promotes providing clean water for everyone on the planet says, no, I'm stepping back and not taking responsibility for this. So it's up to us to know and to act and to write and to protest and say, this isn't acceptable.
Are you putting pressure on the Indian government to do something?
People are writing to the Indian government as well. It's as much down to the Indian government to put pressure on America, but the problem is that governments often don't do what's necessarily right for the people because maybe they will miss out. I know when Obama went recently, I read that they sent an email saying if the Indian government keep mentioning Bhopal gas tragedy, it might have a chilling effect on investment in India. So I think the Indian government aren't necessarily pushing that hard, even though the people of India are horrified and appalled and shocked by what's happened there.
If people listening want to find out more about Bhopal, say who don't know what happened, can they access information on your website?
Yes, I believe Amnesty do have part of their website. If you go onto the internet and just put Bhopal in the search engine, you will come up with the Bhopal organisation as well, and it tells you all about the Sabhavana Clinic, about what happened on that night, the health effects, what's happening to the children, what's being done about it, demonstrations. So there's a huge amount of information on the internet. Just put Bhopal into your search engine and it will bring up the Bhopal organisation. That's probably the best way as well, because you can contact them, find out what you can do to help. People do things like bike rides and tea parties and things to try to raise money, because Sabhavana Clinic is supported by people's donations, doesn't accept it from companies, big organisations. It's purely supported by small people and their individual donations.
And how do you spell it?
Bhopal.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was a report on the continuing effects on the people of Madhya Pradesh in India of the gas leak in Bhopal, which happened in 1984, 27 years ago this December. Well, it's time for the sofa session, which is becoming a nicely regular interlude into our show. Despite taking 100 days off, this week's sofa session artist still managed to perform nearly 300 gigs last year. Our engineer Michael Noyce managed to find a tiny window in Lewis Creven's schedule to record an interview and, of course, an exclusive live version of one of his tracks.
Well, on my sofa today, I have probably Bristol's hardest working musician, possibly even the world's hardest working musician, Lewis Creven. Hello.
Hiya, thanks for having me.
So, I gather you're doing how many gigs in the next 36 days?
Well, at the moment I'm on 42 gigs in 30-something days, and it's looking to continue in that kind of grind for the next few months. So, yeah, full on schedule at the moment.
Yeah, so why is this then? Are you a sucker for punishment, or is it the only way you can actually make a living as a professional musician?
Well, I do make a living as a musician, so it's kind of great to get out as much as possible, you know, shop doors open kind of thing. But I'm just quite a proactive person. I feel uncomfortable if I'm ever at home, kind of about 8 o'clock at night, so I have to go out and play. It's kind of my daily ritual now.
So do you actually have time for any other kind of life?
Not so much. I'm kind of just completely absorbed in music at the moment, which is really lovely. I like to travel as well, so with the band, we go all over the southwest and beyond, playing gigs. And a lot of the acoustic stuff I do is based in Bristol, but I'm always travelling, always listening and playing. So.
Yeah, so you do a kind of variety of music then, really?
Yes, with the band, we do a lot of rock, blues, funk and other bits and pieces, and on my own I do more folk-orientated kind of things.
Okay, I gather your band's actually got an EP.
Yes, we do. It came out last year. It's been doing really well. I'm really pleased with it. And we're just working on the next one, but we're working on a full album now. But the EP we've done is a little four-track thing, and yeah, we're really proud of it, and hopefully we'll have big things on the next one.
And so what's it called?
It's an eponymous thing. It's called the Lewis Creven Band. It's a self-titled thing.
So that's available for download or
CD? It's available just about everywhere. We have it at our gigs. You can buy it in CD form at Head in the galleries, and you can find it on Amazon, iTunes, on Spotify. Pretty much everywhere you look, it's there.
That's fantastic. So how did you get into music in the first place?
Well, playing my instrument. My brother used to play guitar, and I really liked what he was doing, so I would kind of follow on after what he was doing, and playing in a band, I just kind of like to get out and kind of mix with people and play. It's kind of just been a natural progression from once a week to twice a week to, you know, now about 8 or 9 gigs a week. So,
what sort of musical influences have you got?
My influences are quite a wide-ranging thing. I suppose like my heroes on guitar are like Stevie Ray Vaughan and Derek Trucks, and vocally people like Jeff Buckley and Lenny Kravitz. They're kind of my vocal heroes, but I'm into absolutely everything. I listen to Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan from the Pakistani singer, and he's a real source of inspiration for me when it comes to vocals.
And when you write your own songs lyrically, is there any specific kind of...
I suppose all my lyrics are quite introspective. Naturally, I'm kind of looking at myself and kind of analysing other people's lives from my own point of view, and I try not to get too depressing with lyrics. I try and keep it a bit more uplifting, you know. I mean, for example, the song I play today is basically kind of just saying, you know, whatever you want to do, you know, you're able to achieve it within your own power.
You are actually going to play one of your songs for us right now. So it's called...
It's called Sky is the Limit, and it's available on the EP.
Okay, and what's it about again?
It's just about if there's, you know, something you want to do, people can put you down, but if there's something you want to do, you can go for it. Go and do it.
Okay, so this is Lewis Creven with The Sky's the Limit.
How do you know what you want when you don't know what you've got? How do you know what's right in a world that's clearly not? Well, they say your life ain't sweet 'cause it offers you no say that you won't grow because you have no roots. Oh, but sky is the
Lewis Creven with The Sky's the Limit. So if people do really like what they've heard and want to get in touch, if you've got a website or...
Yes, lewiscrevenband.co.uk, and you can find us on Facebook, MySpace, Reverb Nation, the whole kit and caboodle. We're up online, so come and find us.
And presumably if somebody wants to go to a gig, that's where they're going to have to look, because
yes,
there's far too many for you to mention here.
Yeah, all our gigs are up on the website and online, and our next one in Bristol is December 3rd. It's a Saturday at the Reckless Engineer.
So do you actually have a big fan following already?
Yes, we've got a fan base all over the southwest, a lot in Bristol, a lot in Wales, and down on the south coast as well. They like us down there, and we play a residency in Fareham down on the south coast, and they really like us there. In fact, someone's actually got the album cover tattooed on their arm down there, which is quite fantastic.
Blimey.
Yes.
So is it really a good piece of artwork, or do you think it was just he's that big a fan that he had to put your album on there?
Well, I think it suits being a tattoo. I think he's just a hardcore fan of the band, but it does look like it's a good tattoo.
Oh, so there we go. Lewis Creven, thank you very much. And
thanks.
If you like the band, get yourself a tattoo.
Thank you to Lewis Creven for taking the time to talk. And thank you also to Michael Noyce. The website for the artist again is thelewiscrevenband.co.uk. And his surname for the uninitiated is Creaven. Thelewiscrevenband.co.uk. We come to our next installment of Treasure Island, which continues unabated, written by Robert Louis Stevenson, of course, and read by Malcolm Grieve. This week it's chapter 27, but it's the first half of chapter 27 because it's quite a long one.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 5, My Sea Adventure. Chapter 27, Pieces of 8. Owing to the cant of the vessel, The masts hung far out over the water, and from my perch on the crosstrees I had nothing below me but the surface of the bay. Hans, who was not so far up, was in consequence nearer to the ship, and fell between me and the bulwarks. He rose once to the surface in a lather of foam and blood, and then sank again for good. As the water settled, I could see him lying huddled together on the clean, bright sand in the shadow of the vessel's side. A fish or two whipped past his body. Sometimes, by the quivering of the water, he appeared to move a little as if he were trying to rise. But he was dead enough for all that, being both shot and drowned, and was food for fish in the very place he had designed my slaughter. I was no sooner certain of this than I began to feel sick, faint and terrified. The hot blood was running over my back and chest. The dirk, where it had pinned my shoulder to the mast, seemed to burn like a hot iron. Yet it was not so much these real sufferings that distressed me. For these, it seemed to me, I could bear without a murmur. It was the horror I had upon my mind of falling from the cross trees into that still green water beside the body of the coxswain. I clung with both hands till my nails ached, and I shut my eyes as if to cover up the peril. Gradually my mind came back again, my pulses quietened down to a more natural time, and I was once more in possession of myself. It was my first thought to pluck forth the dirk, but either it stuck too hard or my nerve failed me, and I desisted with a violent shudder. Oddly enough, that very shudder did the business. The knife, in fact, had come the nearest in the world to missing me altogether. It held me by a mere pinch of skin, and this the shudder tore away. The blood ran down the faster, to be sure, but I was my own master again, and only tacked to the mast by my coat and shirt. These last I broke through with a sudden jerk, and then regained the deck by the starboard shrouds. For nothing in the world would I have again ventured, shaken as I was, upon the overhanging port shrouds from which Israel had so lately fallen. I went below, and did what I could for my wound. It pained me a good deal, and still bled freely, but it was neither deep nor dangerous, nor did it greatly gall me when I used my arm. Then I looked around me, and as the ship was now, in a sense, my own, I began to think of clearing it from its last passenger, the dead man, O'Brien. He had pitched, as I have said, against the bulwarks, where he lay like some horrible, ungainly sort of puppet. Life's size, indeed, but how different from life's colour or life's comeliness. In that position I could easily have my way with him. And as the habit of tragical adventures had worn off almost all my terror for the dead, I took him by the waist as if he had been a sack of bran, and with one good heave, tumbled him overboard. He went in with a sounding plunge. The red cap came off and remained floating on the surface. And as soon as the splash subsided, I could see him and Israel lying side by side, both wavering with the tremulous movement of the water. O'Brien, though still quite a young man, was very bald. There he lay with that bald head across the knees of the man who had killed him, and the quick fishes steering to and fro over both. I was now alone upon the whole ship. The tide had just turned. The sun was within so few degrees of setting that already the shadow of the pines upon the western shore began to reach right across the anchorage and fall in patterns upon the deck. The evening breeze had sprung up, and though it was well warded off by the hill with the two peaks upon the east, the cordage had begun to sing a little softly to itself, and the idle sails to rattle to and fro. I began to see a danger to the ship. The jibs I speedily doused and brought tumbling to the deck, but the mainsail was a harder matter. Of course, when the schooner canted over, the boom had swung outboard, and the cap of it and a foot or two of sail hung even under water. I thought this made it still more dangerous, yet the strain was so heavy that I half feared to meddle. At last I got my knife and cut the halyards. The peak dropped instantly. A great belly of loose canvas floated broad upon the water, And since, pull as I liked, I could not budge the downhaul, that was the extent of what I could accomplish. For the rest, the Hispaniola must trust to luck, like myself. By this time the whole anchorage had fallen into shadow. The last rays I remember falling through a glade of the wood and shining bright as jewels on the flowery mantle of the deck. It began to be chill. The tide was rapidly fleeting seawards, the schooner settling more and more on her beam ends. I scrambled forward and looked over. It seemed shallow enough, and holding the cut hawser in both hands for a last security, I let myself drop softly overboard. The water scarcely reached my waist. The sand was firm and covered with ripple marks, and I waded ashore in great spirits, leaving the Hispaniola on her side with her mainsail trailing wide upon the surface of the bay. About the same time, the sun went fairly down, and the breeze whistled low in the dusk among the tossing pines. At least, and at last, I was off the sea, nor had I returned thence empty-handed. There lay the schooner, clear at last from buccaneers and ready for our own men to board and get to sea again.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve for reading the first half of Chapter 27 of Treasure Island. The second half of the said chapter next week. Well, to get you in the mood for a piece coming up by Tony Gosling, to get you in a rambling mood, here is Ralph McTell with Streets of London.
Have you seen the old man in the closed down market, kicking up the paper with his worn out shoes? In his eyes you see no pride, and held loosely at his side, yesterday's paper telling yesterday's news. So how can you tell me you're lonely, and say for you that the sun don't shine? Let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London, show you something to make you change your mind. Have you seen the old girl who walks the streets of London, dirt in her hair and her clothes in rags? She's no time for talking, she just keeps right on walking, carrying her home in two carrier bags. So how can you tell me you're lonely, and say for you that the sun don't shine? Let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London, show you something to make you change your mind. All-night cafe at a quarter past 11, same old man sitting there on his own, looking at the world over the rim of his teacup. Each tea lasts an hour and he wanders home alone. So how can you tell me you're lonely? Don't say for you that the sun don't shine.
Let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London. Show you something to make you change your mind. Have you seen the old man outside the seaman's mission? Memory fading with the metal ribbons that he wears. In our winter city, the rain cries a little pity for one more forgotten hero and a world that doesn't care. So how can you tell me you're lonely and say for you that the sun don't shine? Let me take you by the hand and lead you through the streets of London. Show you something to make you change your mind.
That was Ralph McTell and Streets of London. Well, with the mild November we've been having this year so far, it's a good weather to be out walking whenever you have a free afternoon. It's quieter during the week and it pays to be imaginative. Even some dogs do get bored with doing the same walk every day. If you're going to try out a new path though, it's as well to have a good map and to know your rights. And if landowners are messing walkers about by blocking paths or not providing signs, the best organisation to tell you what they are is not necessarily your local authority, who are these days screened behind walls of automatic telephone switchboards designed to make you give up. Nor is it many of the landowners themselves. No, it is the Ramblers Association and Ramblers groups themselves who are by far the best authority. So Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to Avon and District Rambler Group's Bristol Chairman Peter Gould about your rights as a walker.
I'm Peter Gould and I'm the Chairman of Bristol Group of the Ramblers Association.
Peter, what are your rights when you're walking in the countryside? Because quite often you find, you know, you're going along a marked footpath and either all the signs disappear or else you come up against what should be a stile, but it isn't a stile, it's barbed wire.
If you're on the line of the path, it should have been kept clear. It is the duty of the highway authority to assert the public's right by making sure there isn't barbed wire, that there isn't brambles, that where there should be a stile there is a stile, although preferably there would be a gap or a kissing gate, which is easier for many people to get through. You have a legal right to clear as much of an obstruction as is necessary to go on your way. This does not mean that you can go and tear down a 140-foot of fence and burn it, as happened in a famous legal case in the 1930s. You can just clear enough to get by yourself. A farmer shouldn't put a ball in a field cross by a public footpath, unless it is a ball of a beef breed accompanied by cows, which apparently takes its mind off attacking ramblers. Young bulls, bullocks, are generally playful and inquisitive rather than malicious. The trouble is, they are quite heavy and they haven't got brakes. I always find that if you try and stroke the nose of the most inquisitive one, they all shy off. But if they are coming at you on a slippery downhill slope, they can be a little bit worrying, but there's no reason why they shouldn't be there. A farmer has to keep his livestock somewhere. That's what farms are for.
And if you're in a situation where a bull is coming towards you or a bullock, it's not always easy to tell the difference.
Obviously, you consider your own safety. It's no good arguing the law with a bull. You get out of the field, go to the highway authority and say you think it shouldn't have been there, contact the farmer and suggest that perhaps it's been a bit temperamental. But don't try and argue with the bull itself.
Can you tell me something about the background to the Ramblers Association and how it was formed in the first place?
Well, the Ramblers Association was founded in 1935 as a national body bringing together local Ramblers federations. In this part of the world, there was the West of England Ramblers Federation, which stretched from Cornwall up to Gloucestershire and Wiltshire. So the Ramblers started off as a federation of federations, if you like, with the intention of serving walkers' interest, as it still tries to do. nowadays it is more or less aligned to highway authorities, which is a rational thing to do because I'm a footpath officer as well as an area chairman, and footpaths are highways. But there are also 400 or 500 odd groups which are walking clubs and also do some footpath maintenance, footpath survey as well.
What is a footpath officer? What do you do?
Essentially, I suppose, I'm an amateur footpath lawyer. I talk to councillors, I talk to council officers. I receive complaints of the kind you mentioned earlier. Here is a path that we cannot get through. Can you do anything about it? And I know who to go and ask to do about it. And if necessary, I know which bit of the law to invoke to make sure it's done.
Okay. What about the whole history of our right to roam? Because if you go back long enough, we could walk in the countryside wherever we wanted, pretty much. And it was really through the enclosure of land, the privatisation of land, that we lost this right.
Well, I suppose you can go at least as far back as 1066 on this, when an invading army turned up and said, OK, this is ours. I presume they said it in Norman French. Land ownership has more or less developed on the basis of that. I think it's a bit late in the day to try and rewrite Norman history. And pragmatically speaking, we have accepted private land ownership. But it is legally qualified. The idea that because someone owns the land, they can do absolutely what they want with it and keep everybody off it is not sound in law, nor indeed desirable in practice.
And so do you find yourself sometimes coming up against very strong lobbying from these powerful landowners groups like the Country Landowners Association?
Yes, of course. Whenever you suggest that perhaps the public right to access to the countryside should be extended, they all come up with the most ingenious reasons why this should not be done. My favourite one recently was when I raised the suggestion that perhaps we might have more access to woodland, and a chap from the Country Landowners Association said, the problem is if people touch larch trees, they get some kind of larch pox and wither and die, which I doubt.
Now, Peter, can you just tell me a bit more about your association here in Bristol, what you do, how you organise that?
Around Bristol, we have the Ramblers Avon area, which takes in Bristol, South Gloucestershire, Bath and North East Somerset, each of which has a footpath secretary dealing with the local authority, and we meet together and exchange bright ideas and hard luck stories from time to time. Within Bristol, we have two rambling groups. One is the Bristol Ramblers. It's a territorial-based rambling group which also does some practical footpath work. But there is also the Brunel Walking Group, which is for people who, in Ramblers terms, are young, which seems to mean under 40. Similarly, in Bath and North East Somerset, there are a couple of territorial-based groups, and in South Gloucestershire there are three territorial-based groups, again with the younger persons Brunel group operating there as well.
And whereabouts do we find you? I suppose I'm talking about on the internet, or do you have a postal address?
These days the internet is probably the simplest. It's bristolramblers.org.uk.
Avon and District Ramblers Group Bristol Chairman Peter Gould there explaining some of the legalities of rambling to dialect Stone Gosling. If you want to know more, or go on the Avon and District Ramble yourself. You can find them on the web, as ever. Peter said, avon-ramblers.org.uk, or I have some phone numbers too. For membership, you can call Jean on 01454 419 274, or for general inquiries, it's Maureen on her mobile phone, which is 07960 473378. I'll give you those phone numbers again at the end of the show in case you haven't got a pen handy. Time for some poetry. Tim Burrows can't be here in person, but he has produced a CD in the past called Soundscapes, which is him performing music and reading poetry. So let's have a bit of that, and let's have a road sign.
A sign stands nonchalantly on a street corner. Beware, imagination at work. Beneath it lies a hole into the depths. the depths of the human soul. From it, an erotic moan is emitted, part sigh, part groan. A sign of life, like life, part pleasure, part pain.
Thank you very much to Tim Burrows, and more poetry in the coming weeks. His t-shirt proclaims that we have returned from the ashes. Jess Barks is here with the What's On Guide. Hello.
Hello, this is the What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Thursday, December the 1st, Wednesday 13 will be performing with support from Michael Munro and also Crash Diet at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Tickets are £16 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. Into Friday, December the 2nd, Emily Teague will be performing with support from Andy Novak and also Ruth Royal at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Tickets are £5 each and doors open at 8 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present TLI. This three-piece punk group hail from Bristol and recently have released their debut album, Rough and Ready. This is a song from that album and it's titled Scaffold. TLI with Scaffold from the debut album Rough and Ready. For more information on them, you can check out www.myspace.com/TLI band, or you can search them on Facebook. On Saturday, December 3rd, the Lewis Creven Band will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts around 9 p.m. Also on December the 3rd, Chumbawamba will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Tickets are £16 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, December the 4th, Bad Manners will be performing with support from Max Splodge at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £18 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. What t-shirt will he wear next week, and what will it say? wait and find out in our next exciting instalment. Okay, just before we read the credits, I will be telling you the phone numbers of the Bristol Ramblers Association group. Now, thank you very much for all of the contributors tonight. That is all from Dialect This Week. Our guest was Jack Higgins of TLI, The Local Idiots. Features were by Anthea Page, Tony Gosling and Michael Noyce. And we had a poem, courtesy of Tim Burrows. And we had a story, courtesy of Nick Payne. The What's On Guide was by Jess Sparks, and the engineer was Michael Noyce, and the producer was Jess Sparks. And I've been John Peters Cullen. So, the Ramblers numbers, and those numbers again, Avon and District Ramblers Group. For membership, call Jean on 01454 419 274. Or for general inquiries, it's Maureen on her mobile, which is 07960 47 33 78. And they're on the web at avon-ramblers.org.uk. Until next week, take care, goodbye.
No, thank you, Turkish. I'm sweet enough.
Resembles tea.